bells of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling.
This Wednesday, March 17th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., WBAI will be celebrating St. Patrick's Day. No, I mean Malachy McCourt Day. That's because the city of New York has declared March 17th Malachy McCourt Day. So this Wednesday, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Malachy McCourt will interview Malachy McCourt about Malachy McCourt. We will also be telling stories, playing music, and taking your phone calls about how did you celebrate Malachy McCourt Day. So come celebrate Malachy McCourt Day on WBAI this Wednesday from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. and listen to Malachy McCourt interview Malachy McCourt on Malachy McCourt Day. It doesn't get any more Irish than this.
Our grave thy victory.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion coming up.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
To the rebellion. This is Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Today we are talking about three things. We're talking about environmental racism in Cancer Alley. We're talking about what's getting in the way of popular understanding of climate science, or at least some of what's getting in the way. And we're talking about new information from the Center for Biological Diversity.
Cancer Alley is the term local residents use for a long stretch of the lower Mississippi River. The area is about 85 miles along the river as it snakes through Louisiana to its mouth at the Gulf of Mexico. It's an industrial hub with nearly 150 oil refineries, plastic plants, and chemical facilities. That's 150. As we said, it's locals and also environmentalists who call it Cancer Alley or Death Alley. We're going to talk about why they call it that, and some listeners might already be able to guess why it has these names. Currently, this area is not deindustrializing, it's further industrializing, and United Nations is raising a red flag about it. On March 2nd, 2021, a group of independent United Nations human rights experts released a statement branding as environmental racism the further industrialization of Cancer Alley. These toxic oil refineries, plastic plants, and chemical facilities that poison the air and the water and the earth are primarily concentrated. In fact, they are intentionally sited where African Americans and poor people generally live and have lived for generations, such as in Louisiana's St. James Parish. Now, Death Alley residents suffer disproportionately from, for example, cardiovascular and respiratory diseases, reproductive and developmental disorders, and cancer. In fact, 7 of the 10 census tracts with the highest cancer risk in the United States are in Death Valley. Seven of the 10. The descendants of the enslaved people who once worked the land, United Nations experts observe, are today the primary victims of deadly environmental pollution that these petrochemical plants in their neighborhoods have caused. This form of environmental racism, they write, poses serious and disproportionate threats to the enjoyment of several human rights, including the right to equality and non-discrimination, the right to life, the right to health, right to an adequate standard of living, and cultural rights. And I would add that this form of environmental racism is also the production of our climate crisis as a racist crisis. According to the UN experts, the combined carbon emissions in a single parish could exceed those of 113 countries if the new petrochemical complexes that are on track for construction are actually built. That's the emissions of 113 countries. Noting that federal environmental regulations have failed to protect people residing in Death Alley, the experts call on the United States as well as St. James Parish to recognize and pay reparations for the centuries of harm to Afro descendants rooted in slavery and colonialism and to deliver environmental justice.
One night, my 3-year-old daughter asked me, "Mommy, why does it smell so bad?" It was overwhelming, like something was burning, I was scared my sinuses would be inflamed and my daughter would get sick. I prayed and went to sleep, but sleep didn't come easy. I feared we might not wake up in the morning. 5 generations of my family have lived in the St. James Welcome community. It used to be so vibrant. During the 1960s, my grandfather helped integrate the parish public schools. Going through the struggles of segregation and fighting for voting rights, he welcomed the development of a fertilizer plant in the 5th District. He believed it would create job opportunities for young blacks, a good salary, employer-paid health insurance, and pension plans. My great-grandparents, Velmo and Clara Reed Kelvey, had passed down 40 acres of land. My parents built our home on the family land in the 1980s and took pride in it. My siblings and I spent hours playing outside and exploring the field. I wanted that for my daughter. Instead, we've had to worry about what's being pumped into the river, soil, and air. When I was in college, my whole family got really bad skin rashes. Doctors could not figure out how to get rid of them. We ended up having to put bleach on our skin to kill the rash. It was very painful, but it was the only thing that worked. Then, in 2016, my mom was diagnosed with autoimmune hepatitis. I suffer from debilitating sinus infections and often have to miss work. For years, we didn't know why we were getting sick. Now we do. If my grandfather were still living, he would stand up and fight with us against the pollution. Shouldn't everyone want a world where all the kids grow up with their basic human rights, like clean air and water?
You just heard Shamel Levine on the Women of Cancer Alley. It's a video series produced 2 years ago, and it's available on the website of the Center for Constitutional Rights, where you can learn about the grassroots organizing in Death Alley. Now, no doubt that grassroots organizing inspired the United Nations experts to issue their powerful call for reparations. You know, the tireless work of organizations like, for example, Rise St. James, which was founded by Sharon Levine, have shined a light on the harms these toxic industries have inflicted on the people, and inflicted with the assistance of the politicians these industries have purchased. The grassroots organizing also made possible this important moment when President Biden signed his executive orders targeting climate change and industrial pollution.
With this executive order, environmental justice will be at the center of all we do, addressing the disproportionate health and environmental and economic impacts on communities of color, so-called fence line communities, especially those communities, brown, black, Native American, poor whites. It's hard, the hard-hit areas, like Cancer Alley in Louisiana, or the Route 9 corridor in the state of Delaware. That's why we're going to work to make sure that they receive 40% of the benefits of key federal investments in clean energy, clean water, and wastewater infrastructure. Lifting up these communities makes us all stronger as a nation and increases the health of everybody.
Cancer Alley. These two words, as reporter Tristan Barrick noted, have rarely been uttered from such a high federal office or even state level ones in Louisiana. For Sharon Levine, those words, she said, felt so positive. It was so wonderful, she said, that we now have a president who cares about the lives of the people here. You know, we can only hope Joe Biden cares enough to deliver environmental justice to the people in Cancer Alley.
Back when I was in junior high, the plant was built. Nobody told us what they were making, and we didn't try to find out. Now, about 50 years later, we learned that one of the things they produce is neoprene, which uses chloroprene, a likely carcinogen. And even though there's really no safe level of exposure, the emissions reading in our area are sometimes more than 100 times the so-called suggested limit. We started talking to our community and getting word out. We made lists of people in the neighborhood. There were so many who had cancer, had died of cancer, or were still suffering. It was unbelievable. How could so many people be unlucky? We were told we were fearmongers. Well, wouldn't you be fearful if you lived here? The company says you can't prove that cancer is because of us. We say you can't prove it's not. Most of the parish officials turn a blind eye to our concerns. I know there are tax dollars at stake. They're always accusing us of trying to shut down the plant. But we just want monitoring and health studies. We're just trying to get the emissions to a level that's safe. My husband Walter passed in June, and I'm going to continue to fight.
Often in the news coverage of catastrophic weather events, we read that climate scientists can't say with certainty that the extreme weather is caused by global heating. And yet we read, sometimes in those same articles right alongside, that there is no serious scientific debate over whether global heating is happening. Every peer-reviewed climate scientist, and it's true, every peer-reviewed climate scientist says the planet is heating up and that that heating is caused by human activity, especially by fossil fuel and greenhouse gas emissions. So we have high confidence in overall global heating, low confidence that specific weather events are caused by that global heating. So inquiring minds want to know, how can it be that there is such high confidence in overall global heating, but such low confidence in how it relates to the actual weather that we're experiencing day to day? The answer has to do with the standards scientists use for making claims, especially the thresholds they use for statistical significance. Let me explain. And in my explanation, I'm aiming for an accurate summary, not exhaustively rigorous methodological explication. We're a radio show, not an academic conference. I had to say that in case any scholars are listening. So the planet heats up, and we know that that alters the patterns of global airflow. We know it warms the oceans. We know it melts the ice. We know all those things. But when a journalist calls up a climate scientist and asks them about a specific temperature in a specific place, not average global temperatures over time, but a specific temperature, or asks about a specific storm, not storms in general, but one specific storm, or journalist calls the climate scientist and asks about a specific iceberg breaking off from the Antarctic ice shelf, not melting in general and overall, but some specific change in the ice. Those are entirely different questions. A scientist interprets that question as, can you prove that this specific temperature would not have occurred in the absence of human-caused global heating? Like, for instance, the recent cold snap in Texas that overwhelmed the power grid. A climate scientist can prove that global airflow is changing, and that change makes temperatures highly erratic. Lots of cold in some places, lots of heat in other places. But can the climate scientist prove that this cold in this place at this time would not have occurred otherwise? Another way of phrasing this question is, can you prove that Texas would have had the same deep freeze last month if the carbon content of the atmosphere had been a lot lower? That's an extremely narrow question, and it's very hard to prove. It's also not the issue at all when it comes to pragmatic questions like what should we do as a society about the climate crisis? Likewise, for any specific storm, you climate scientists can prove that the oceans are warming and that warmer oceans make stronger storms. That's worth emphasizing. I'm going to say it again. Warmer oceans make stronger storms overall. But can we prove that Hurricane Harvey, for instance, would not have happened or would have happened but been a weaker storm in the absence of human-caused global heating? Again, that's an extremely narrow question. Think about the evidence that would be required to prove something like that. Of course, on the day after the hurricane hits, when the journalist calls up, the climate scientist has to say they don't have the evidence to prove that specific narrow claim. And same goes for ice melting. We know the globe is heating up and that melts ice. But can we prove that any given glacier would not have melted, like the one that broke through a dam in Uttarakhand, India last month, or that any given iceberg would not have broken off from Antarctica without human-caused climate change? No, we usually can't prove that level of specificity. But these are the wrong questions to ask. Journalists, when they ask it, they're asking the wrong question. What the climate scientists should be saying and what the journalists should be reporting, climate scientists do say this in reports, but somehow it doesn't make it into most of the news coverage. What they should be saying is that these extreme weather events are exactly what the climate science models predict. The modeling of global heating tells us that temperatures are going to get more erratic with some vicious cold snaps and some blistering heat waves, and it will kill and injure a lot of people and destroy a lot of property. The models say all that. But the models don't predict precisely where the temperatures will occur, precisely which people will suffer from it, precisely which property will get destroyed. To use an extreme example, a question like, did your climate model predict that my pipes would freeze, is not a reasonable question. The answer is no, it did not predict which specific pipes and which specific houses would freeze. Likewise, the climate modeling predicts more storms and stronger storms, but it doesn't predict exactly where and when specific storms will make landfall. So given this, did it predict Hurricane Harvey? Well, yes and no. Yes, it predicted stronger storms, and Hurricane Harvey was a stronger storm, but no, it didn't predict it down to the exact time and place. This yes-no-ness isn't getting communicated in news coverage, and it's contributing to climate confusion and climate denialism in the general population.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. We're talking about what's getting in the way of popular understanding of climate science.
And we are on WBAI Radio. Now, there's more to say. So far, I've been talking about a failure of communication, but there is a separate issue that interacts with this one, and that's the issue of scientific standards. This is the one that takes a little bit of expertise and a little bit of patience to explain. Climate science uses statistical methods in its modeling. Almost all science uses statistical methods in one way or another. Biology, chemistry, physics, astronomy, geography, climate science, sociology, political science too, all use some version of statistical inference and statistical analysis. Very often, that involves taking a sample and extrapolating from that sample to a larger population. In medicine, they take a blood sample and they observe that blood sample in order to know what's happening in the rest of the body. If a disease is present in that blood sample, it's probably present in the rest of the body too, with very, very high confidence. Or a biopsy for cancer, for instance, takes a sample of tissue from the body and observes that tissue to figure out what's happening in the part of the body that wasn't sampled. It's the same basic idea with a little bit of hand waving and analogy. It's the same basic idea in social science. You can't actually ask everyone in the country or everyone in the world the same question. So you sample and you try to extrapolate. Climate science does this too with soil samples, air samples, ice samples, and so on. Now, once you've gathered your sample, how do you know that what you observe in the sample is true in the rest of the world? Maybe, just maybe, there's something wacky about your sample. So how do you determine whether your sample is representative? The answer involves a lot of math, and radio isn't a great medium for math. The guts of the answer, though, is that you want to know that the variation in your sample, that is, the stuff you observe going on in your sample, can't be caused by pure chance. We have to know that it's not pure chance. The math they do in applied statistics is measuring whether what's going on could be caused by chance or not. We're never 100% sure, but we can be sure up to a certain percentage, say 90% or 95%. Or if we're really good and really lucky and our sample's really carefully done, 99% confidence. Scientists set a threshold above which they say it's definitely not due to chance. The sample's measuring something real outside of the sample, and I'm 90% sure if 90 is my threshold, or 95% sure if 95 is my threshold, or 99% sure if 99 is my threshold. This is what they mean when they say statistical significance. It's statistically significant from zero if the variance in the sample meets that threshold. The threshold is set by the scientist. It's a human construct meant to make sure of our findings, to report only what we're very highly confident of. All those results that fall below those thresholds, they're said to not be statistically significant. If it's above that threshold, we say it is statistically significant. Now, scientists never set the threshold below 90%. They usually set it at 95 or 99. That's really high. It makes things really hard to prove. You have to have really high confidence before you go say them. And before you can even get the math to show a 99% statistically significant threshold. And that's a good thing, depending on what we're proving. If the question is whether a medical treatment works or doesn't work, and we're going to change what we teach all the doctors in the world to do on thousands or even millions of patients, then the threshold should be pretty darn high. If we're going to discontinue a procedure or we're going to recommend a new procedure, we have to be very confident that that procedure is going to be effective. But I'm going to say something that some people will find controversial. Not everything science is trying to demonstrate should be subject to the same standard. Broad questions can be hard to prove. Super narrow observational questions, especially with lots of conditions attached to them, are really, really hard to prove. How do you prove with empirical evidence at 99% confidence that Hurricane Harvey would have had the same strength if the carbon content of the atmosphere had been lower? It probably can't be done. But again, the answer to that question as phrased has almost no importance for public policy. We have to phrase the questions right, and we have to adapt our standards appropriately to the importance of the answers. High scientific standards are a good thing for basic science, and they must be maintained. But they can be used in such a way that they paralyze public policy questions, especially questions of climate science. We should not be throwing out statistical significance thresholds. I'm not arguing for that. But we should use conceptual extrapolation way more robustly than we do. That is, given everything we know, what do we expect to happen? That's a different kind of question than can I prove this specific narrow claim at this specific significance threshold? Given everything we know, what do we expect to happen? That's the question that's more urgent for big scale policy like climate science and what society should do in response to the climate crisis. For peer-reviewed articles, you do your rigorous statistical methods on your limited samples, as you should. But for public communication, scientists, think through the conceptual implications of what you're finding, the conceptual implications of what you're finding, and communicate that. Tell the journalists that. Tell the policymakers that. That's quite a different exercise from statistical inference as it's usually practiced. To repeat, I'm not advocating for throwing out scientific conservatism and scientific modesty. I'm arguing for more effectively communicating what we have already demonstrated. What we've done by and large in terms of scientific communication has not worked. The general population does not understand the situation. They don't know that we are within a few years of irreparable catastrophe. General public does not know that. Very few people understand that. Between the scientific community and the news media, we have failed to inform the general public. We should focus way, way more on communicating the trends that our models predict. Trends, not specific instances, are the questions we need to be answering. Those are the things we're all going to care about the most years from now.
The Center for Biological Diversity, or CBD, has sued the administration of California Governor Gavin Newsom for approving thousands of oil and gas drilling and fracking projects without the required environmental review, reports the online news magazine Common Dreams. In its lawsuit, CBD claims that the California Geologic Energy Management Division, or CalGEM, failed to adequately analyze environmental and health risks before issuing fossil fuel extraction permits as required by law. Now, according to the suit, California regulators approved nearly 2,000 new oil and gas permits without proper environmental review.
Like they did 2,000 wrong.
Exactly. Exactly. Not only has the Newsom administration approved oil and gas permits, it has also, CBD claims, failed to act on Newsom's stated desire to ban fracking, which, of course, is not what Joe Biden wants to do. Anyway, that's an aside. Now, this lawsuit is a welcome development here in California, especially since just this past September, the nonprofit group Consumer Watchdog had issued a disturbing and scathing report on these permit approvals. Consumer Watchdog found that CalGEM, quote, granted 190% more permits to drill new oil and gas production wells in California in the first 6 months of 2020 over Newsom's first 6 months in office. In addition, after a 9-month moratorium on fracking that began in July 2019, CalGEM issued 48 new fracking permits to Aera and Chevron between April and July 2020. During his first year in office, Newsom issued 211 fracking permits, end quote. So it's great that on the heels of this important report, the Center for Biological Diversity has moved to take California to court. The fact that the Newsom administration has been issuing fracking permits makes clear that we really have to pay less attention, to what our so-called allies in the struggle for climate justice say, and pay more attention to what they do. Newsom has consistently presented himself as an environmentalist and as one who is concerned about our climate crisis, right? Mm-hmm. But this issuing of permits reveals otherwise. As Greenpeace put it in its 2021 climate progress report, while Governor Newsom, quote, has made supportive public statements about transitioning away from oil and gas, he has nevertheless failed to make meaningful progress on a plan to phase out California's oil and gas production, protect frontline communities from the health impacts of oil drilling, and ensure a just transition for workers and communities, end quote.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
This Wednesday, March 17th, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., WBAI will be celebrating St. Patrick's Day. No, I mean Malachy McCourt Day. That's because the city of New York has declared March 17th Malachy McCourt Day. So this Wednesday, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Malachy McCourt will interview Malachy McCourt about Malachy McCourt. We will also be telling stories, playing music, and taking your phone calls about how did you celebrate Malachy McCourt Day. So come celebrate Malachy McCourt Day on WBAI this Wednesday from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. and listen to Malachy McCourt interview Malachy McCourt on Malachy McCourt Day. It doesn't get any more Irish than this.
Our grave thy victory.
On Wednesday, March 17th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m., Vocal New York presents a Mayoral Candidate Forum, a caring and compassionate New York City. Tune into WBAI at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org on Wednesday for this opportunity to hear how candidates running for mayor will address homelessness, drug policy, policing, and incarceration. That's Wednesday, March 17th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m., right here, live on WBAI. AI New York.
This is Baby K.
And this is DJ Kyle McNeil.
Of The Sweet Spot. And we are so excited to announce our brand new time slot, Tuesday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight.
Sangre Soulful Sounds, old and new.
Brand new day, Tuesdays at 10 p.m.
Only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York's Pacifica Radio.
Sweet Tuesday, darling, Tuesday.
The next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting is Sunday, March 21st. 2021 at 1 p.m. The meeting will be held by teleconference. The call-in number is 623-600-3766. The access number is 963-003. Also, the CAB will hold officer elections at the May meeting. The election will be for chair, vice chair, and recording secretary. In order to vote in the election, you have to be a CAB member. To be a CAB member, you have to be a member of WBAI. You will have to attend the next three CAB meetings and take part in the meetings. Again, the call-in number is 623-600-3766. The access number is 963-003.
On the count.
The U.S. prison system incarcerates approximately 2.5 million people, the highest number of any industrialized nation, while prisons remain the fastest growing industry in the country.
And people trapped in the justice system are particularly vulnerable to the spread of the coronavirus.
All my people up the rave, bro. All my people up the spot, fam. All my people in the group home.
To On the Count, WBAI's Prison and Criminal Justice Report, Tuesday evenings at 9 p.m., as well as on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. That's right here on listener-sponsored WBAI.